Turn with me this morning, though, to Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. I'm going to be reading verses 1 through 3. Just to set this up, last Lord's Day, we completed a fairly lengthy series on the six woes that Jesus very publicly pronounced on the Pharisees and lawyers in response to their continual displays of hypocritical legalism. And in response to that scathing indictment, Luke tells us that when Jesus left them, they began to be very hostile and to question him closely on many subjects, plotting against him to catch him in something he might say. Our text this morning lends even more credence to the fact that chapter divisions and verse divisions are not inspired. Our text this morning is really just a continuation of what Luke was writing at the end of chapter 11. How should Jesus' disciples, those who were following him and those who had a genuine interest in what he had to say, how should they react to what Jesus had just said to the Pharisees and the lawyers? In short, how should we react to what Jesus said to the Pharisees and the lawyers? And we've talked about this. Again, we did a lengthy series about hypocritical legalism and the dangers therein and how we should avoid those types of behaviors ourselves. Well, this morning's text gives us even more reason to delve even more deeply, at least into this one aspect of the legalism that was characteristic of the Pharisees and the lawyers, and that's hypocrisy. How would Jesus have his disciples react to what he had to say to the Pharisees and lawyers in that regard? Well, let's read the first three verses of this passage. Luke says, under these circumstances, that is in light of what had just gone on very publicly again, after so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were stepping on one another, he began saying to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. But there is nothing covered up that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, whatever you have said in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in the inner rooms will be proclaimed upon the housetops. Now, I decided to limit our study this morning to these three verses, because they serve as both a follow-up to what Jesus has said to the Pharisees and the lawyers, and they actually serve for a fitting introduction into what Jesus is going to talk about in this sermon. We're going to find out in this sermon that this was not your routine sermon. This is a sermon that was often punctuated by questions, and Jesus stopped and answered each of those questions as he preached. This is not like a standalone sermon like we see in Acts chapter 2, for example, on the day of Pentecost. This is really an opportunity for Jesus to speak and to be questioned on certain things. And I think this is very fitting, given that Luke tells us that one of the motivations of the Pharisees following his indictment of them was that they sought to ask him questions to entrap him. Jesus welcomed that. He welcomed that because he knew the answers. He welcomed that because he was confident in the answers. And he was confident in his answers because he is God of very God, come to this earth in the flesh. So he had all the confidence in the world to answer these questions, no matter how annoying they were, no matter how belligerent the people were who were asking these things. He always was quick to give an answer to those questions. And again, we're going to cover this sermon in the weeks to come in fairly substantial depth. So first things first, Luke wants us to understand the environment that Jesus was in when he preached this particular sermon. He had just left the home of the Pharisee who had invited him over to lunch. And as he indicated at the end of the previous chapter, Jesus sensed that there was a growing hostility. Even as he was trying to leave, he was being bombarded with questions in an attempt to catch him saying something that they could use as the grounds to charge him with heresy or blasphemy. And Luke paints a picture for us now by saying, under these circumstances, that Jesus began to speak to the crowds of people who had gathered to hear him, And he also tells us, gives us a kind of a rough estimate about how many people were there. Well, we know that there were so many people there, they were stepping all over each other. So you can kind of gather that there's quite a substantial crowd, right? How many, though? Do we have any clues? Well, actually, we do. Some of your translations say that there were many thousands of people. And granted, whenever that term is used, that phrase is used, that can just mean a lot of people, right? I mean, we use the same terminology today. How many people were there? Oh, it must have been millions. When really, it really wasn't millions. It was just, we're trying to signify a large number of people. That would be acceptable in terms of interpreting this passage, but Luke actually uses a very specific word here to indicate, at least on one level, how many people were there. I think the King James Version says that there was an innumerable multitude of people who had gathered there. But that's not accurate either. The word Luke uses here is the word myriadon. Does that sound familiar? Myriadon. Myriad. There were, and he uses it, myriadon is in the plural. So there were myriads of people there. And again, we use that word today to describe a large number. In the Greek, though, the word myria, right, simply means 10,000. So if there was a plurality of a myriadon there, then we can at least know that there were more than one group of 10,000. So at the very minimum, we're talking 20,000 people. Most commentators feel that the most common use of this word in first century Greek would indicate that there were probably 30, 40, 50,000 people there. Now understand, they didn't have PAs. They didn't have this. And so everyone would have been crowding in to hear exactly what Jesus had to say. And so this is where we get this idea that they were crowding in on each other. They were stepping all over each other to get as near as possible in order to better hear what he had to say. Now, what did he have to say? A lot. And Lord willing, we'll see this in the coming weeks. But Jesus begins by addressing his disciples. Now, let me ask you this. Is this to be understood as Jesus speaking just to the 12? Or is it to be understood in the larger frame of mind where he's talking to all of his followers? Well, we need to understand that the word mathetes, disciples, is generally translated, unless stipulated otherwise, it's generally translated as all of Jesus' followers. All of his pupils, all of those who were genuinely interested in what he had to say. Luke could have very well used the phrase, the 12. And he uses that back in chapter 9. He uses it elsewhere. The other apostles writing use that, the 12, to signify just the 12. But mathetes is generally used to describe all of those who were present. So, we get the idea that Jesus is saying these things to everyone within earshot. And that includes those who were stepping all over each other to try to hear him. Now, there are three reasons that we can use to substantiate that he's not just talking to the 12. First, again, is that Luke could have used the 12. He could have said he was talking to his inner circle. He could have said he was talking to his apostles. He could have said that he's talking just to these 12, but he doesn't. He doesn't do that. Secondly, in verse 4, in the same stream of thought, without anything in the text to indicate that he's changing his audience here, Jesus addresses the same group to whom he's speaking as his friends. His friends, which is a very common way for Jesus to refer to anyone and everyone who had a genuine interest in what he had to say. Remember, he says, I no longer call you what? Come on. I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. You're now my friends. And this was a moniker that was used to describe those who had genuinely shown an interest in learning from him. We could say that this was those who were saved, but I think that would even miss the mark, because by this time there were still a lot of looky-loos, right? There were still a lot of people just curious about learning more from him. And they were friendly toward him in that regard. And so he calls them his friends. And thirdly, notice in verse 13, we're told that someone in the crowd, having heard everything he was saying, wanted to offer his own 2 cents into the discussion. So if someone in the crowd is just, you know, volunteering to blurt something out, that means Jesus was talking to everybody that was there. Anyway, let's get to the sermon itself. Again, having just excoriated the Pharisees for their legalism, for their hypocrisy, Jesus warns his disciples to avoid them like the plague. He says, look, I've just railed against these people, these Pharisees and lawyers. I've just pronounced 6 separate woes on them for this type of behavior. Avoid these people. Avoid them. He says, beware the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Now, you'll be relieved to know that I have no intention of conducting some sort of impromptu baking class this morning. But in order for us to understand what Jesus is saying here, we do need to understand what leaven is, right? I mean, if you read through this, this is typical when we're reading Scripture. We come across a word or a phrase and we think we understand it, only to find out later that we never understood it at all. I want to avoid that. So let's all get on the same page concerning what leaven is. Basically, leaven is anything that can be added to dough to make it rise. How many of you bread makers are here with us this morning, right? If you've ever made bread, you know that you can buy that little packet of brewer's yeast, and you take it and put it in your mixture, your bread mixture, and you roll out your dough and you make a little ball and you set it into the refrigerator, or I think you can leave it at room temperature, right? And it rises. It expands. It's almost like magic, right? To those of us who really don't know anything about it. But back then, they didn't have a supermarket. They didn't have this little thing where you can go and buy, what is it, Fleischmann's? Yeah. Fleischmann's yeast. They would have to depend on natural processes to cause the bread to rise. And guess what? There are all kinds of bacteria in the air that we're breathing right now sufficient to cause dough to rise. These bacteria are known as lactobacilli. Aren't you glad you know that? That's just a fancy way of saying that these are bacteria that eat lactate. They eat lactate. And as these little bacteria eat, the proper way of saying it, this is, as they eat, their byproduct is that they excrete sugar, carbon dioxide, and alcohol. Yeah. Have you ever smelled fresh bread and it smells like alcohol? That's why. Because the bacteria are making alcohol and carbon dioxide, and that's what causes the bread to rise. In Jesus' day, that process could take a long time. I mean, imagine, you make your dough. It's usually sourdough, in case you're interested. It's usually sourdough bread. They would make this lump of dough and they would leave it out, and it would have to sit sometimes for days before it would ever rise, right? Once a batch of fermented dough was created, only a portion of that dough would be used every time a batch of bread was made, and they would continually add to the rest of it. How many of you have ever made friendship bread? Right? And you've got that thing called the what? The starter. And I remember all the rage years ago when this friendship bread craze started. You know, people were saying, you can actually use this starter for years. The same starter. You just take a little bit of it and add it to the new stuff, and it causes more bread, right? And so you always have this starter. There's a lady in Wyoming who is said to have the world's oldest sourdough starter in existence. The starter that she uses to make her sourdough bread is 122 years old. And I was really impressed by that until I went to another website that really angered the French, who make probably the best sourdough bread on the earth. There's a guy in France that claims to have a sourdough starter that's over 300 years old. It's not impossible. It's possible. I read it on the internet. So was leaven a good or a bad thing? In Jesus' day, was leaven a good thing or a bad thing? Well, it depends. It depends. Luke 13:21, Jesus says that the kingdom of God is like leaven, which a woman took and hid in 3 pecks of flour until it was all leavened. And that's just another way of saying that just like leaven causes bread to rise and swell, the gospel causes the church little by little to grow and thrive until at last the whole body's increased in both size and influence. So in that way, the leaven of the gospel, this addition of the gospel, this seed of the gospel that is planted in the church and germinates and grows and thrives, that type of leaven can be a good thing. Most of the time, however, the word leaven is used in an entirely negative context. The Jews, for example, and many even today, still eat unleavened bread. Why? Well, there were three reasons. First, you'll remember that during the Exodus, when the Jews were required to be ready at a moment's notice to depart Egypt, they were told not to make any leavened bread. Why? Because there would not be any time for the bread to rise. And so they were taught or told to leave the leaven out of the bread because of the time it would take for the dough to rise. Second, from the time of their wilderness wanderings onward, the Jews were commanded to eat unleavened bread as a reminder of what the Lord had done for them by taking them out of Egypt in great haste, in a hurry, from their bondage there. In fact, if you look at Deuteronomy 16, you don't have to look there, but you can jot this down in your notes. But in Deuteronomy 16, the Jews are given very specific instructions concerning how they're to observe the Passover during the month of Abib, which is our month of April. During that month, they're told, you shall not eat leavened bread with the Passover sacrifice. 7 days you shall eat it with unleavened bread. And this type of bread is qualified as the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste. And they're to eat this unleavened bread so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. And so there was a ceremonial aspect to their eating unleavened bread. Thirdly, one of the reasons they still don't eat leavened bread was because leaven became to be recognized as representing sin. Leaven became a type of sin or an illustration for sin. This is used both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. In fact, out of the 88 times the word leaven is used in the New Testament, 87 of those references are negative. The only exception was that Luke 13 passage that we just read. Now, should we be concerned that Jesus used the word leaven in a positive context when all the other 87 times are negative? No. Why? Because He's God. Because He can use that any way He wants to. But even beyond that, because the definition of leaven is simply that which changes something incrementally, gradually, slowly, whether good or bad. Leaven is something that works subtly, slowly, to modify something else. Let me give you just a couple of examples of how this word is used in the New Testament. Look at 1 Corinthians 5. 1 Corinthians 5. We looked at the letter to the Corinthians in very much depth, but you can remember that one of the things that Paul had against the Corinthians, which resulted in 2 letters to them, more than likely 3 letters or 4, one of the things that's most pronounced about them is their proud self-absorbed, self-centered behavior. And he writes to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8, he says, "Your boasting is not good." Understatement of the century. "Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough?" And in this regard, if leaven is the sin of boasting, he's saying your boasting will eventually be contagious. Your boasting will cause others to behave like you, especially if you are respectable in all other areas, especially if people admire you or think highly of you. He's saying, clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ our Passover also has been sacrificed. Therefore let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. To be saved means, in part, to be unleavened by God's grace. To have all of those sinful qualities removed from us. Or at least to give us the ability to no longer act in that way. And this is the reminder that Paul's giving. He's saying to the Corinthians, this boasting, and by the way, all the other things that I'm going to talk to you about, this boasting is not good. Remove it. Why? Because you've been unleavened by the grace of God in salvation. Act like it. Paul says something similar in Galatians 5. Verses 7 through 9. You know that passage. He says, you were running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? Right? He's saying this persuasion did not come from him who calls you. A little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. You were running well. And what happens when leaders start running? What do followers do? No, when leaders start running, followers follow. What if the leader starts running in the wrong direction? What are the lemmings going to do? They're going to follow. This is why he's saying this disobedience that was on display by the Galatians, some of them, was having a leavening process on the whole. Because a little leaven will ruin the whole lump. This is another reason that we seek to guard a regenerate church membership. You will not be a member of this church and sin with impunity. You will not sin without being called to account in accordance with Matthew 18:15 and following, which is the prescribed method for dealing with people who seek to be leavened in an otherwise pure lump. We can't allow that. Because the minute you allow that to take a hold, before long, you got others adding even more leaven. Anybody in here ever been in a church that has fallen apart because of leaven? Right? You've seen it happen. I've seen church splits happen over the most innocuous, really silly things that started off that big, and by the time it's over, this is huge. How did that happen? Because a little bit of leaven ruined the whole lump of dough. In both of these examples, again, Paul's substituting the word leaven for any number of errors that had been introduced into those churches, causing them to be polluted, to stray from the truth that they had initially heard and embraced. The same thing was happening with the Jews in our text this morning. Over the years, that the Pharisees had been ministering among the Jewish people, they had established themselves, as we've discussed, as the experts. They were the wise ones. They were the revered ones. The Pharisees and the lawyers had very carefully used error as a means of garnering the favor of the people. And it was subtle. You know, no false teacher walks into a place and immediately starts teaching things that are demonstrably false. They just don't. False teachers worm their way in and they get into people's good graces and they get people to love and admire them, and then they start introducing the questions, the same type of questions that Satan had for Eve in the garden. Has God really said? And if I'm of a lemming mentality, if I'm a follower and not a leader myself, then you might just hook me. And then what am I going to do? I'm going to go to somebody else and say, have you not heard? I've got a newfangled understanding of this particular doctrine, this particular truth. And before long, what happens? The whole lump is leavened. Now, what was the particular kind of leaven that the Pharisees and lawyers had added among the people? It was, as Jesus says, their rank hypocrisy. He says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. I'm glad he pointed that out. And I'm sure they're glad he pointed that out. Because if he had just said, beware the leaven of the Pharisees, I'm sure everyone there would have said, which one? Right? I mean, most of the people comparing what Jesus had to say with what they'd been taught by the Pharisees would have said, which particular sin are you talking about? But here he says, hypocrisy. And I know we've talked a great deal, as I said, about hypocrisy over the last few weeks. But I want us to revisit this one final time. Because like leaven, if not removed, it will have a devastating effect on us corporately and certainly individually. This is something that we really, really need to discuss one more time. Now, I've told you what the word hypocrite means, right? It comes from two words, hupo, which means what? Hupo, under. Krino, hupokrino, we get our word hypocrite from that, means a mask. And so, the word for hypocrite is literally someone who hides under a mask. And this was originally used with regard to plays that would be presented in Greek culture. And the masks were designed to cover the real identity of the person beneath them. And people watching the play were always wondering, who's really under there? Who is that really? And it's very effective, by the way. I mean, think about the number of actors and actresses over the years who have been stereotyped. Right? Harrison Ford, I hate to break it to anybody, but Harrison Ford is not Indiana Jones. But we see him like that, right? And some actors and actresses can never get another job anywhere unless it's playing that particular character, because that's who they're known as. That's how effective this hypocrisy in its purest sense can be. You can convince people that you are someone who you're not in actuality. And that's wrong. And one day it will all come out in the wash, right? Verses 2 and 3. There's nothing covered up that will not be revealed, and hidden that will not be known. Accordingly, what you've said in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you've whispered in the inner rooms will be proclaimed upon the housetops. I've told you before how frightening it is to consider the fact that we would have these bubbles over our head that everyone could see. Like in the cartoon, in the comics, you have these bubbles over your head that tell what you're thinking. Anybody want one of those? No. Why? Because how you're acting and what you're thinking are generally two different things most of the time. What do we call that? Hypocrisy. Hypocrisy. And there's coming a day when all the masks will be taken off. All the tools of deception will be useless. And everyone in this room will be revealed just as we are. Paul gives a couple of similar teachings in other places. In Romans 2:6, for example, he reminds his readers that God will render to each person according to his deeds. When? Verse 16. On the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 4:5, you'll recall Paul says, therefore do not go on passing judgment before the time, but wait until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the things hidden in the darkness and disclose the motives of men's hearts, and then each man's praise will come to him from God. That's a frightening thought. One day, everything you've ever thought about everything and everyone will be brought out into the light. Yeah, I heard a couple of moans. Think about that. Jesus is telling his disciples to beware the very real dangers of consuming the leaven of the Pharisees' hypocrisy, because once it was allowed to enter into their system, as it were, it would subtly change them in like fashion. The sad reality is we've not learned anything in 2,000 years, because hypocrisy still ranks number one as, I think, the most common and one of the most offensive things that exists in the local church. And bear in mind, when I say the local church, I'm not talking about other churches. I'm talking about in this church as well. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The reason people who follow Christ are so often labeled as hypocrites is because they are. And I'm here to tell you, even this morning, that everyone in this room, myself included, is a hypocrite. But that's not really the question. I mean, that's the indictment that's common to all of us. But the real question is, what are you doing about it? How are you seeking to remove the leaven? Or are you seeking to remove the leaven? Now, I realize, you know, this might touch on a nerve or two. I mean, when's that ever stopped me? But I think it's high time that we came out of this phase of denial that we're in most of the time. Most of us want to think the best of ourselves. Most of us are so busy thinking about how well we've done, how well we've performed under our mask, that we don't even realize any longer that we have the mask on. But I think recognition of the problem, as they say, is 9/10 of the solution. So let's all come to grips with the fact, let's all admit, yeah, we're all hypocrites in one degree or another, at some point or another. The sooner we can do that, the sooner we can work to eradicate the leaven and avoid the embarrassment and the humiliation of the day that Jesus speaks of here. I was preparing for this message, I came across something written by Spurgeon. If you ever come across something written by Spurgeon while you're studying, that's a good thing. Spurgeon had a wonderful way of expressing things that we often find difficult to express. And I want to give you a few of the points that he made about hypocrisy that really stood out to me. And I'm going to use what he says, and then I'm going to add my own comments as we go. But let me just show you that there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them, and they're not long. So some people were freaking out. 6, well, that's already 12. It's okay. Number one, Spurgeon says a hypocrite may be known by the fact that his speech and his actions are contrary to one another. As Jesus says, they say and they do not. Talking is easy, but walking is hard. Any man may attain to speak, but acting is difficult. We must have grace within to make our life holy. But lip piety needs no grace. In other words, lip service will never get any grace. Lip service is not a demonstration of grace. Lip service is just that. It's just language, it's just words that you say that you really don't mean. How many times have people come to you with their problems? How many times does that prayer list come to you in your email and you tell people, I'm going to pray for you about this, that, or the other thing, and you never do? Talk is cheap. If you tell somebody, I'm going to pray for you, you better be praying. And don't hide behind the excuse, well, you know, I just couldn't find time. Things were really busy this week, and you know how things are. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. If you tell someone you're going to pray for them, I would recommend you go somewhere right then and there and pray for them. Here's a novel concept. How about when you're face to face and somebody says, I need you to pray for me about something. Come on. Take them and pray for them. Don't set yourself up as the hypocrite by saying, oh, I'll pray for you. And then allow that hypocrisy to expand even more when the prayer is answered and you're like, oh, praise the Lord, as if you prayed. You see how easy it is to wear the mask? Talk is cheap. Lip service won't get you anywhere. How often have you noticed something going on in the church? You're convinced it needs to change, but rather than engage and participate in the solution, you simply sit back in judgment of those who make the decisions. Are you part of the problem or are you part of the solution? Because if you sit there acting all happy and satisfied, when on the inside you're actually boiling about something, you're a hypocrite. Let it out. Let it out. If you're feeling that way, tell someone. But don't just come to us with a problem. Come to us with ideas about how to solve the problem. None of us are professionals. Even the men who stand up here, even the elders that serve you, we're not professionals. We are fallible, frail, meek, humble human beings. We're going to make mistakes. Repeatedly. Don't put on the mask of the hypocrite and say, well, everything's fine, everything's okay, if it's not. Remove the leaven from among us. Number two, Spurgeon says the next mark of a hypocrite is that whenever he does right, it is that he may be seen of men. To him, virtue in the dark is almost a vice. He can never detect any beauty in virtue unless she has 1,000 eyes to look upon her, and then she is something indeed. The true Christian, like the nightingale, sings in the night, but the hypocrite has all his songs in the day when he can be seen and heard of men. The hypocrite is always that person that says, look at me, look at me, look at me, and all the good I'm doing. Look how smart I am. Look how wonderful I am. When on the inside, there's nothing to commend them to God. This reminds me of some of the professing believers on Facebook. I recently reacted kind of strongly, and I think justifiably so. You know, anytime I see these posts like, I'm proud to say that I've never done fill in the blank. Right? I'm proud to say that I've never watched a single episode of fill in the blank. The problem is with that third word, right? Or that second word. I'm proud. Yeah, that's your problem. Do you think I give a care in the world whether you've watched something on your television or not? I don't. What I do care about is what's going on in here that might compel you to watch something you shouldn't be watching. The bigger problem is that we need to guard everything that comes through our eye gates and our ear gates. We need to be acutely aware of who resides in us, the God we serve, and we need to be aware that we not do anything that would discredit our testimony or bring shame or reproach on Him. That should solve all of your TV watching problems. But then to go on Facebook and say, well, I'm proud to say that I've never watched a single... Who cares? I mean, why would you say that to begin with? Because you want people to say, oh, how pious you are. Oh my, how holy you are. And at the same time, are you not trying to inflict harm on them as they might be struggling with those issues? While we're on the subject of Facebook, how about some of the things believers post? If you're on Facebook, I've seen you. and I will stalk you. I am that Facebook lurker. And guess what? I'm interested in what you're putting out there, and I'm interested in what your friends are putting out there. Because you are who you associate with. Beware that you don't wear that mask of hypocrisy by posting things that you know are going to cause other brothers and sisters to stumble. It's not only hateful, it's hypocritical. Number three, hypocrites love titles, honors, and respect from men. Spurgeon says there was another evidence of a hypocrite who was equally good, namely that he had strained at a gnat and swallowed a camel. Always suspect yourself when you are more careful about little than about great things. This was one of Jesus' chief complaints against the Pharisees, wasn't it? They would tithe from every minuscule herb in their garden, all the while neglecting their own parents. They would focus so much on the minutiae. Because to the degree that we focus on the minutiae, people think that we're really solid. You really must have it together. Brother, if you're tithing from every little sprig that pops up in your garden, you must have it all together. And Jesus says, yeah, you're doing that, but you're neglecting the weightier things. You're neglecting the big things. Are you good at pointing out every little thing you see in others while neglecting your own much larger problems? If so, you're a hypocrite. Number four, these people neglected all the inward part of religion and only observed the outward. As the Savior said, they made clean the outside of the cup and platter, but within they were full of extortion and excess. There are many books which are excellently bound, but there's nothing within them. And there are many persona that have a very fine spiritual exterior, but there's nothing whatever in the heart. Has the Lord genuinely done a work of grace in your life? Is He yet at work in you? If He is, there will be evidence. Godly fruit will be produced from a heart in which God dwells. You can fool me, you can fool each other, but you'll never fool God. Number five, you may know a hypocrite by another sign. His religion depends on the place or upon the time of day. He rises at 7 o'clock perhaps, and you'll find him religious for a quarter of an hour. For he is, as the boy said, saying his prayers to himself in the first part of the morning. Well, then you find him pretty pious for another half hour, for there's family prayer. But when the business begins and he's talking to his men, I won't guarantee that you'll be able to admire him. If one of his servants has been doing something a little amiss, you'll find him perhaps using angry and unworthy language. Now, this is applicable to all of us, right? Who are you when no one's looking? When you're all alone on a Friday evening trying to get home, because you have places to go and people to see, and you're stuck in traffic on I-35, 1604, 281, whatever the case might be, who are you when no one's looking? What are you saying to the people around you who don't move quite fast enough for your liking? What are you thinking about the people around you who might cut you off, who might get the advantage over you by two car lengths in this traffic jam? What are you thinking? What are you saying? Are you thinking, saying, or doing things that would cause you to be ashamed or embarrassed if your brothers and sisters were with you in the car? I mean, that's a big enough burden, right? But we don't realize Christ is there the whole time. And yet, if our brothers and sisters were in the car with us, we wouldn't say some of the things or do some of the things that we do because they're there. What is that? It's hypocrisy. Men, how do you speak to your wife? when no one else is around? Do you speak to your wife the same way when no one is around as when the pastor's there at dinner with you? It's okay, you men can say no. Because we're all hypocrites. We say things to our wives, we say things to our children that we would never dream of saying if someone we loved and admired and trusted were around. Why? Because we don't want them to think ill of us. Ill of what? Ill of who you really are? Parents, do you discipline your children differently when folks from the church are present? Or perhaps even more damaging, do your children see you acting one way in church and another way outside of the church? You want to devastate your children? You want to perhaps do irreparable harm, but for the grace of God, to your own children? Be someone else at home than you are at church. Your children need to see Christ. And they're going to see it in you or they're not. And guess what? If you're behaving hypocritically in that way, guess what you're raising? Hypocrites. Why? Because it's perfectly acceptable to say one thing and live another way. To be one way in one place and another way in another place. That's Spurgeon's point. The man's all pious when he's home and when he's trying to raise his children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. He goes to work, somebody messes up, and he rains down hell fire on their head. That man's a hypocrite. Number six. Anybody wish I'd just stop already? I do. But there's one more. Spurgeon says, there's another sign of the hypocrite. And now the lash will fall on my own back. And at this point I'm thinking, Spurgeon, has it not fallen on your back with the first five? He might have had it all together, right? But at least on this one, he says, now the lash will fall on my own back. And on most of us too. Hypocrites and other people besides hypocrites are generally severe with others and very lenient with themselves. This goes back to a point I made a minute ago. We all have a tendency to point out the small things in others while neglecting the very large things in our own lives. We tend to be very hard on them in the minutiae. You know, here's one. Parents, how can you demand that your children clean up their rooms when they walk into your room and it looks like a pigsty? Not funny. Right? What kind of credibility you got going on there? When you're making demands on your children that you yourself don't live up to. Your children mess up in the slightest ways. You're on them like white on rice. And you spend the whole day messing up and give it nary a thought. I've told you before, this classic do as I say and not as I do mentality will never work. And if you're demanding that your children or even those around you live according to a rule set that you yourself are not living according to, you're a hypocrite. Each one of us, to one degree or another, or at some point or another, has been leavened with the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. We've all done it. But it's something that we must deal with. We must. Individually. Do you realize, to the extent that you deal with these things individually, it will have a profound effect on all of us corporately. To the extent that you deal with these things individually, just like leaven ruins the whole lump, removal of leaven in one person's life will have a dramatic effect on removing the leaven from us all. Let me just close with this. It's very tempting to read this passage and conclude that the reason we should avoid the leaven of the Pharisees is because there's coming a day when all of this hypocrisy will be exposed. In other words, we better knock it off because there's coming a day when we might get caught. If that's your rationale, then you've lost the battle already. The reason we want to remove the leaven from our lives is not out of a fear that we might get caught. The reason we seek to remove the leaven from our lives is because Christ died to enable us to do so. The reason we seek to remove the leaven from our lives is because God is worthy. Not because we fear getting caught. You know, going back to the children, if your children are obeying you strictly out of fear, you're not raising them properly. You want children who obey you because they love you, because they respect you, because they trust you. Not because if they don't obey, they're going to get whacked. You see the subtlety there? Just how subtle that leaven can be. We seek to remove the leaven from our lives because He is worthy. We should be motivated out of nothing else but a love for the Lord and a genuine desire to live in a way that magnifies His sustaining grace every step of the way. Let me just ask you this before we go. What's one of the primary motivators of hypocrisy? Jesus tells us in the next verse. One of the primary motives of hypocrisy is fear. Fear of what? Fear of how people will perceive us if we show them who we really are. But we learn from Christ Himself as well. Perfect love casts out fear. We have no reason to be afraid. Why? We'll talk about that next time. We'll talk about that next time. Let's close for now in a word of prayer.